Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hi, welcome back to Neat, to a new Neater Neat, perhaps. I'm really excited to have my new co-host here. Hey, Dad, how you doing?
Good, Tay. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really, really psyched to have you on the show.
I'm excited to be here.
Usually we kick off each episode by giving a little rundown of our weeks, but I was thinking back to the first episode we did. Liz and I both talked about our first experiences with alcohol, and I thought maybe as a little intro, you could give us perhaps yours.
Hmm. Well, that sounds like, I guess that you're old enough now where I could tell those old stories. A statute of limitations has more or less run out on
I'm in my 30s. I think I'm an adult now.
I guess you could hear that kind of stuff. It won't be a bad impression on you, huh?
I can talk about alcohol now. I've been serving it for a decade.
All right. Well, my first drink came when I was 15. A buddy of mine named Rodney, we were hanging out at the pool that we hang out at during the summer, and it was the summer before we were to start high school. And, of course, high school in those days was just sophomore, junior, senior, because junior high was your freshman year, was the end of that, 7, 8, 9. So high school was 10, 11, 12.
How far off were you from the drinking age? Was it 21 by then?
No, drinking age was still 18.
Okay, so it's still bad, but not as bad.
That's right. It was 3 years better than that bad.
Okay, that works.
Yeah, 18. So, you know, there were seniors in high school that legally could drink.
All right.
And
all right.
So
different times.
That's right. Different times. It was a different world. At the time, you know, there were people going to Vietnam, and they figured if you could go to Vietnam, you could drink a beer.
I mean, I think that's fair. I think that's the least we can do.
But for some reason, we were excited about we're going to be getting ready to start high school. And there was two guys that were there that were always there. And they were getting ready to enter their senior year in high school. Well, you know, you're nobody when you were a sophomore going in, you know, and the senior guys, you looked up to them. And one of them was like the captain of the football team. And the other one was, he was kind of like Matthew McConaughey's character in Dazed and Confused, if you've ever seen that.
You were friends with these people?
Well, I wasn't really friends. That's what was so odd. We went to the same pool. And I knew who they were. I didn't think they knew who we were. We knew them, of course. But, you know, we played in some pickup basketball games and volleyball games out there at the pool. But we didn't really know them other than just, you know, who they were. And one day they came walking up and they said, "Hey, David Bowie's going to be playing in Charleston next week," or whatever it was. "Do you want to go to the David Bowie concert with us?" And we like look over our shoulder. Who, us?
What?
Yeah. So they said, "We've got two extra tickets." So I said, "Well, I'll ask if I can go." So went home and asked. I didn't think, you know, Grandpa Dan, I didn't think he'd let me go, but he said yes. So we were going to the concert. The last concert I'd asked him to go to, I was 8 and the Monkees were going to be playing, and he wouldn't let me go to that one.
Well, no, not the Monkees. Those, they're bad influence, but David Bowie.
Yeah, David Bowie's all right. So anyway,
also David Bowie.
Yeah. So Charlie and Luke, those were the two seniors. They came
picked up
me and Rodney. And
it sounds like they're going to sell your kidneys or something. This is too good of a deal.
I know. I still don't know why, you know, why they did that. They pick us up in like their T-top Camaro, and we're driving to Charleston with the wind in our hair. And Luke turns around and hands me a Miller Pony.
Which, oh, it's the little ones, right?
Yeah, 7 ounces. Those were the little ones. They used to sell them like that. And they had a case of Miller Ponies and just started handing them back. Well, I'd never had a beer in my life. Well, that was my first beer.
A Miller Pony. All right.
Yeah, so we drank those on the way up. And, you know, we didn't drink very many. It was only like about a 45 minutes to an hour drive. And we just drank a couple on the way up because I'd never drank beer, so I wasn't pounding them or anything. But we stopped to get a hamburger or something at some place on the way, and old Rodney rolled out of the car and threw up in the parking lot.
Too many ponies.
I guess ponies, so.
It's a whole horse.
Yeah. So anyway, we had to straighten him up and clean him off. And so then we go into the David Bowie concert. And so not only was this my first day ever to drink a beer, but it was my first joint too, because we're sitting there at the concert, and here comes a joint just passing down the aisle. And you just smoke it and pass it on, and here comes another one the other direction. And they just were being passed back and forth throughout the whole concert. And it was his Diamond Dogs tour, with his big hit at the time was Major Tom.
I am floored by how jealous I am of your first drink story. Mine was like a Bartlett and James in a closet. Like, this is so much better.
A Bartlett and James in a closet. Yeah, this was a little better.
That describes a lot of my life, really. But yeah. David Bowie was involved.
Yeah. Yeah, they had a lot of big acts that we didn't know at the time. I mean, I remember going to the old Memorial Fieldhouse in Huntington, and we went to see REO Speedwagon. And there happened to be an opening act for REO Speedwagon that we'd never heard of, but we watched them anyway. And it was Aerosmith.
I just happened into it. That's great.
Yeah.
Didn't know where to go but up from there.
Yeah. Well, that started my career of drinking. I'd never drank up until that point.
I feel like that's a pretty solid first go, you know, right? Miller's Miller, but, you know, a good size.
Yeah.
Good amount of beer.
Yeah. Yeah, you handle a few ponies.
I mean, this is a really charmed event you just happened into. Good for you.
I'm kind of like the Forrest Gump of drinking, huh?
I don't know what that means.
Well, you know how Forrest Gump kept ending up at all these historical events.
I guess so.
Through no power of his own, he just showed up and fate, you know, bestowed them all upon him.
Wow. Good. I was about to ask, how was the show? But I can't imagine it was anything but phenomenal.
Oh, we were blown away. Yeah. And we were tripping. He came out. He did ground control to Major Tom's, and he was on a pneumatic arm that came out over the crowd, but he was in a spotlight, so you couldn't see the pneumatic arm. And we were all like, David Bowie's flying, man. He's floating up there. Look at him. David Bowie's floating.
I mean, I could believe, with or without the aid of marijuana, that David Bowie could fly.
Yeah. That's,
yeah.
And Luke, the Matthew McConaughey kind of guy, he was sitting there going, all right, all right, all right.
Was he?
That's the way I remember it.
Okay, all right. I don't, like, your stories, like, feel like they were penned by somebody just, like, writing, like, ideal Americana. I'm glad that you lived the life that we're like, that doesn't really happen to anybody, right?
Well, that happened to me.
Good for you. Good for you, Dale. That's a great start. All right. Well,
yep.
I don't know. How do you transition away from David Bowie? I don't know.
Well, you could say that David Bowie portrayed some scary characters, and so we're going on a scary haunt.
All right, that works. I don't know if even Bowie trying to be scary actually was scary. I think no. But
he was scary to some people because they didn't know what he represented.
That's fair. Culturally intimidating.
Yeah. Right. Ahead of his time.
Yes. Oh, man. Well, we are going to talk about some actual spooky territory today, because it is the spooky month. We are deep in the spooky month. I thought a good pairing for the scariest month of the year would be to talk about the Buffalo Trace Distillery. We'll talk about the whiskey a little bit, but mainly I want to talk about the grounds of the distillery.
Because there's more spirits there than the alcohol.
There you go. Yeah. It's Going for some. Good thing is that there's a lot of short circuiting that my brain does when I'm trying to come up with a pun that we have to edit out. I get there eventually, but I feel like you get there right away, so I don't have to do that anymore. That's awesome.
Yeah, the bad jokes. I'm good at that.
I love it. Because I'm bad at the bad jokes, apparently. So yeah. So the Buffalo Trace Distillery, it's rumored to be incredibly haunted. And, you know, it's a pretty old distillery. That makes sense. We'll get to the spooky bit in a minute. I do want to give you a little bit of background. So, you know, you get how old this place is. The Buffalo Trace Distillery is actually home to a ton of recognizable whiskeys. Obviously Buffalo Trace, but also such like mainstays as Blanton's Single Barrel, Pabbi Van Winkle, Sazerac Rye, George T. Stagg, Eagle Rare. These are massive, beloved brands in the bourbon world, all produced under the umbrella of Buffalo Trace.
Good luck trying to get a bottle of Pabbi Van Winkle.
Oh, yeah. The allocation is crazy for that. I worked at a restaurant that got allocated. I was really excited. It showed up on our list, and it was delivered. We got one bottle allocated to us, and my boss had just put it in for himself. He took it home. I got to hold the bottle. I didn't get to drink it.
It's like $1,000 a bottle.
Yeah. And, oh, yeah.
And some people get it and then auction it off or put it whatever. And, I mean, it's several people buy it for like $3,000 or $4,000.
It's quite a thing to behold. Although honestly, when things get that expensive, I don't know, because there are plenty of things that I taste that are $50 bottles that blow my mind. I'm like, how good can it be to be that expensive?
Hey, I tell you what, a $10 bottle will still get you there.
That's true.
I think it's just so you can say you had it is the only reason you spend that much money for a bottle of bourbon.
I think that's true, because I feel like, I don't know, I think my palate has a price cap on it. Like, once it gets above, like, I don't know, $100 bottle, I can't taste the difference. It's all just like, well, this is too good for me. That's it.
You get that cheapness from me. I'm like that, too. I could not spend that money on bourbon and think, oh, yeah, this was worth it.
I feel like that's common sense. Yeah, if it's free, I'll try it, but I don't know. There's good enough stuff. I'm a big proponent of there are excellent bottles at pretty low price points that you can have a good experience with. So that is nothing wrong with that. Honestly, when you learn about the distilling world, that holds up pretty true. You know, you pay a lot for names and labels.
And if you're going to pour Coke in your bourbon anyway, you don't need $1,000 bourbon.
No, I've had people, they will spend 15 minutes asking me about every scotch, single malt scotch I have on my back bar and making me explain it, asking me for taste. And then when they finally decide on it, they'll be like, okay, I'll have that with Coke. And I'm just like, wait, what?
What?
No.
A Scottishman jumps up behind the bar and slaps you.
That's not allowed.
We lied you. Bring disrespect to our drink.
Is that what they say?
Scottish?
Was that Irish?
It might have been. I don't know. It was kind of like Scotty on Star Trek. The engines are dead. I can't get no power.
I don't know what that Star Trek is. That's neither. That's space. Just because his name is Scotty doesn't mean it's Scottish. So Buffalo Trace, ton of whiskeys of all price points under their umbrella. The distillery and the whiskey, they get their name. This is their story. This is their label story, which is always very flowery and cool and on any spirits label. Their label story is that they get their name from the trails or traces, as they were called, of buffalo that settlers and pioneers followed during westward expansion. Now, one of these trails that happened across the Kentucky River just north of what is today Frankfort, Kentucky, was called the Great Buffalo Trace. And that is the location where the current Buffalo Trace Distillery now sits. The Buffalo Trace whiskey itself is a Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey. It's aged for at least 8 years, so decent amount of time. Its mash bill is estimated around 90% corn, so it's very high on the corn quotient. Though this is a trade secret. They don't let any of this out. This is just tasters giving their opinions.
Right.
But this name for both the location and the whiskey, this is really new. This came about in 1999. So before that, the distillery had a bunch of different names and a whole history.
Yeah, different owners and everything else.
Oh yeah, so let's get into a little bit of that, because some of it's, there are a lot of really, it's just one of those real cool happenstances where some of the pioneers that would shape the identity of bourbon all happened to spend some time at the what would be eventually be the Buffalo Trace Distillery. Some really cool figures here. So from its very roots, now this is kind of one of those things that's up for debate. They like to claim that they are the oldest operating distillery in America. That is maybe true if you count that the founders of Leestown, which is the area of Frankfurt that now it's Frankfurt, it's just all considered the same, but Leestown is the area north of Frankfurt where the distillery is specifically located, and that's named after the two founders, these brothers Hancock and Willis, who they founded Leestown in 1775, so before America. And they started distilling, just, you know, for themselves there. Mm-hmm. So if you can call that the beginning of the distillery, then yes, they're the oldest in America. But that's not really, they didn't really have a distillery. They were just some brothers home distilling.
Yeah, they were home brewing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like that they're going to claim it. They're like, no, it started then. Like,
all right. Well, we built it in the spot where they started, so it's continuous.
Well, and Dad, I'm really excited for you in this continual alcohol education. You'll come across a point that I've learned repeatedly, and that's that the history of alcohol is full of people that want to tell really good stories that might smudge the truth a bit to get there.
I can understand that. I work for the railroad.
Oh, okay. All right.
There's a lot of people tell a lot of stories on the railroad that run right over top of the truth.
Well, that's, you know, it's like everybody wants to claim the cool stuff and like not claim the bad stuff. I guess that's a lot of history, but it's very true in alcohol, you know? So to say you're the oldest distillery in America, a lot of people are going to dig pretty deep to get that.
That's
no
right.
No exception here. But so the Lees brothers had their little home brewing. Now, in 1812, a man by the name of Harrison Blanton bought the site, and he started a commercial distillery there. It was pretty small. He sold it in 1870 to a pretty important figure in the history of whiskey, and that man was named Colonel Edmund Haynes Taylor Jr. Fancy name.
Lot of names.
So many names. I'm going to call him E.H. Taylor moving forward, because I just don't want to say that many names. Maybe Colonel Taylor, maybe, like Colonel Sanders. Kentucky has a lot of those.
Yeah, they got a lot of Kentucky colonels.
Now, I guess it can also be like a it's a moniker of respect in Kentucky, I guess, to call somebody a colonel.
Well, it's a title that you can get. You have to apply for it. And you can get it, and it costs you some money, but you can be that. And I know when I traveled around with the railroad, there were certain people that worked in Kentucky, and they'd proudly display their plaque that said they were a Kentucky colonel.
I didn't. But it wasn't until I was researching this that I learned that. I just assumed it was a military thing. I thought that was what that is.
I think you just pay for the right political person, and you get one.
That's so. I want to be a colonel. Do you have to live in Kentucky to be a colonel?
You might have to. That might be a requirement.
If you move to Kentucky briefly, just long enough to become a colonel, and then you leave, do you take the title with you? I'm asking for personal reasons.
Yeah, I think you can take your plaque with you. It goes wherever you go.
Just asking, how long do I have to live in Kentucky to be a colonel is what I want to know.
I think it all comes down to the Benjamins. If you got the Benjamins, you can be a colonel.
All right. Well, apparently E.H. Taylor, he had the Benjamins. but he also was a pretty rad dude. He is considered the father of the modern bourbon industry, and for lots of reasons. One, those Benjamins. He contributed a lot of money to just building up other distilleries. When he bought his distillery, he installed the newest, like, highest tech equipment. This gave engineers opportunities to put in like copper fermentation tanks that had never been seen before, like high tech column stills, modernized buildings, more efficient like sour mash techniques, all sorts of stuff that he allowed to happened with his money. But also, he was a big proponent of bourbon purity standards. He helped get the Bottle and Bond Act of 1897 pushed through the courts, and that was kind of a precursor to the bourbon laws. We've briefly mentioned them on the show. I'm not going to go too into them, but they're basically the regulations that tell you what's in a bottle of bourbon, what it can and can't be, and kind of maintain that if the word bourbon's on the label, it's going to be a good product. So before we had those, which didn't come till 1978, we had the Bottle and Bond Act. And this ensured that any product bearing this label had to be made from one distillation season, from one distillery, from one single distiller. It had to be aged 4 years. It had to be aged at 100 proof, and it could not be otherwise adulterated. And this was really important at the time because this was sort of the Wild West of whiskey. You have people putting like tobacco and iodine in their whiskey to mimic like aging and color notes. You had people diluting it down way below proof to try to stretch it and get a better profit margin. These regulations came in and really preserved and guaranteed the character and the reputation of whiskey at the time.
Yeah, and one of the things that really worked for the distilleries in that area where they established bourbon is they have natural limestone that occurs, and the water that they draw from the streams are filtered through this natural limestone.
Yeah, that's a huge part of that kind of unique. One of the bourbon laws, a lot of people think it says it has to be made in Kentucky. It doesn't. It has to just be made in America. But the reason a lot of it is made in Kentucky, 90% or plus 90%, is because a lot of it comes back to that. Like, the water system in Kentucky is unique to the flavor of bourbon.
The other thing about it that really blew me away was the whole barrel industry behind it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, bourbon, it has to be stored in virgin barrels. The barrels have to be their first time use. They have to be oak handmade barrels.
Foresting lobby had a big part in that. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's a real craft to make these, because there's no screws or nails or anything in there. It's just two iron hoops and wooden staves, and it all fits together where it's, of course, watertight, because you don't want that stuff leaking out.
No.
Well, and it's just fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, in the last episode, we talked about French appellations, which is basically, it's the same sort of quality control. It's like, if you see an appellation on a label of a French wine or a brandy or a cognac, rather, you know how long it's aged, you know where it's from, you know what's in it, you know what's not in it, you know it doesn't have additives, you know it doesn't have coloring agents. There's all this good stuff that comes with the appellation system in France. We don't really have that with our spirits in America, outside of the realm of bourbon. Like, bourbon is one of those that to have that on the label, you can look and you know a lot about the quality there, which I think is really important. I love when a spirit can do that. And it also goes to show you that there are plenty of bottles you can pick up that are pretty cheap that still can qualify for that. So you don't need to make an expensive spirit to make, something of quality.
Right.
So that begins back in, you know, the late 1800s with the Bottle and Bond Act. Now it's kind of fallen out of favor. Obviously, there's other regulations. We have basic customer, you know, or consumer standards that keep iodine and tobacco out of our booze.
Unless you put it in there at the bar.
I mean, I follow a lot of drink blogs, and I saw one of them post. They're generally good, but somebody posted a recipe for like a cigar-infused bourbon in a cocktail, and I was like, that can't be good. So I did some research. I was like, no, it's not. It's super carcinogenic. You're just drinking cigarettes. Like, don't do that. Don't serve your customers liquid cigarettes, I guess.
All right. I'll just say that sounds awful.
It's a bad idea. It's a bad idea. It concentrates the carcinogens. It's not great. But yeah. So for his efforts, there is to this day a small batch E.H. Taylor bourbon that is put out by the Buffalo Trace Distillery in honor of E.H. Taylor. And the cool thing about it is it's also bottled in bond. I mean, that was his legislation. Even though a lot of liquor companies don't really care that much about getting that anymore, the bottled in bond notation, they did that in honor of him. Now, during his stay, he named the Leestown location the Old Fire Copper Distillery, sort of named after his favorite thing to distill in. And along with his, you know, his, he expanded, he upgraded. He did eventually fall in some hard times, but he sold the distillery in 1897, luckily, to another pretty smart, important guy in the world of whiskey, and that is George T. Stagg. If that name sounds familiar to you, that's because George T. Stagg is another brand of whiskey that's still out there, and this is the namesake. Stagg was a former captain in the Union Army. He was a whiskey salesman after the war, and he'd grown close to Taylor through their workings together. So he seized on the opportunity to take over the business. He kept Taylor on for a while. They eventually parted ways because they butted heads, but you know, for under his leadership, they built like the most dominant brand of whiskey in the 19th century. They expanded their operation. They recovered from like a lightning strike in 1882 that burnt the entire distillery to the ground and rebuilt a better, expanded, more modern distillery from that.
Yeah, that happened to a distillery here not too long ago, just last few years.
Really?
Lightning struck one of their rick houses and burned it to the ground with all the bourbon in there. And the thing that was kind of amazing, all the other distilleries in the area, instead of thinking, oh, good, we'll take that market share, they all jumped in and helped rebuild their rick house and stored their whiskey for them or their bourbon so that they wouldn't have to stop the distilling process, and stored it in their rick houses until they were ready to move it in theirs.
I love that. That's where is that? Was that in Kentucky?
Yeah. Yeah. All right there in that area, that same Louisville, Frankfort type area.
I can believe that. You know, a lot of these, I mean, part of its business, a lot of these companies, they, you know, they're under the same big, like giant liquor companies. So they're all friends of, you know, they're all friends and family. But I do that, like, especially in that Kentucky area, a lot of those, main bourbon families really have kind of banded together and created a really cool community. And that's great to hear.
Well, they have positive competition. They want to be the best because theirs is the best, not because somebody else failed.
Right. Oh, that's true. I mean, and it shows in the booze, you know, like you just get better quality, cooler stuff from that rivalry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, you know, they rebuilt by themselves, but during this time, they took on, I guess maybe the figure that matters most to today's story, they took on an office boy who grew up on a neighboring farm by the name of Albert B. Blanton. This will eventually become our next important dude, but we'll get back to him in a second. Around the close of the century, that's when Taylor and Stagg parted ways. Stagg renamed the distillery in honor of him in 1904, so it became the George T. Stagg Distillery, and it remained that for a fair amount of time. Now, that office boy that they took on, he continued to, like, prove his importance to the company, eventually would be the one to inherit it from Stagg, and he inherited just in time for the most transformative event in all of American drinking history. Listeners of the show will know what I'm going to say, but I wonder if you know what I'm going to say, Dad.
Prohibition?
There it is. Yes, Prohibition, the great game changer of American drinking. He took over around the 1920s, just as the Volstead Act was ratified and passed, and this led to the closing of the vast majority of American distilleries. This was devastating for American alcohol. However, Blanton petitioned and received one of four contracts given out from the government to produce medicinal whiskey in Kentucky. So through that and the aid of, I guess, doctors with loose pins, he managed to keep it afloat.
Well, and also drugstores.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You could get a prescription for whiskey or use whiskey as a tonic, so to speak. So,
I think it was Walgreens or something like that that was the main distributor of it for quite a while. Not distributor as in, you know, but selling it.
Yeah. Well, that's something you would get like at the early, like the soda counter, like in like a, would be in like a pharmacy. You'd have a soda counter and you could go and get like a whiskey and maybe some bitters, maybe sweet with a little sugar, and that would be your daily morning intake of whiskey for your quote-unquote medicinal whiskey, which is also that foundation of the old-fashioned that we get. So that's also founded in the medicinal whiskey background.
Oh, there you go. The more you know.
I know. So they managed to stay alive during America's dry spell. And as a reward for his efforts, Blanton got a giant flood under his watch in 1937.
Well, they should have had that sooner to put out the fire.
And I know. Well, that's what they had a fire. He got a flood just about a decade apart. The story goes, through Blanton's swift efforts, he had the place up and running. The place was under 4 feet of water. He had it up and running within 24 hours. So maybe it was just like a nice, thorough cleansing for everything.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure that's the same flood that we had in Huntington during that time, too. Now, I wasn't alive then.
I guess that would make sense.
Yeah, we had the flood in Huntington, too, and it put a bunch of buildings underwater, and then they built the flood wall that we have down there now, after that event. Huh. Yeah.
That's cool. So outside of his quick thinking, Blanton's other big contribution to the distillery was his aesthetic growth. He built a lavish clubhouse. He built great gardens. He built the Stony Point Mansion, which he would move into, and remains on the property to this day. Now he would pass the helm on to the next master distiller. Well, actually, the first person to carry the title of master distiller, which was Elmer T. Lee. He was a young man who showed up looking for a job in 1949. He'd served as a bombardier in World War II and then got his engineering degree from the University of Kentucky. At first, Blanton turned him away and was like, "We're not hiring." I mean, it's 1949, you know, we're dealing with war, Great Depression. There's not a lot of jobs to go around. Lee had a buddy on the inside that basically said, "Just come back and do work." And he did.
You work here? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he did. But he proved himself. He was a smart guy. He had a lot of innovative ideas to, you know, make things more efficient, better, smarter. And he's the guy that eventually took over after Blanton. And in honor of Blanton, the man who turned him away originally, he actually is the one that created Blanton's single barrel whiskey, which is made in honor of Blanton. It's a 51% corn whiskey. The remainder is rye, so that's a high spice quality. It's aged at least 6 years, and this is my favorite part of this. It's aged in Blanton's personal favorite workhouse. This happened to be made out of all steel. It was the only one that was an all steel workhouse, so it would get very hot. That would make the barrels expand and contract a more intense regimen.
Right.
And rumor has it that Blanton would visit his barrels late at night and pet them quietly.
there, little barrel. You'll soon be in my belly.
Yes. Like, I love that. Like, because he seems like, the way that people describe him, he was very beloved, Blanton was. Like, he was pretty modest for all of his success and all of his, you know, how great he was for the company. He was very quiet. He kept to himself, but he would sneak out to the storehouse to pet his barrels. So,
yeah, everybody has their kinks.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Yeah, why not?
It's fairly harmless compared to some things.
Sure, yeah. Maybe that makes the whiskey better. Who knows? Have you ever tried? Yeah. Distillers out there, have you pet your barrels late at night? Ooh.
Yeah, that'll become a requirement.
After Lee's run in 1972, Gary Gayhart took over. You know, just kind of, this is just more like, there were a couple other important master distillers. He retired in 2005. Harlan Wheatley succeeded him. Neither of them have gotten their whiskey tribute yet, but as we have seen through all of these other leaders, all of them have whiskeys. They'll get their whiskeys, I'm sure. And then until its rechristening as Buffalo Trace, you know, the distillery would change hands as far as ownership goes a couple times, but it would continue to grow its operation. Obviously, now it's a massive success with so many amazing products under his labels. Not just whiskey, not just bourbon. They have vodkas, they have gins. And I thought this was cool. In 2016, they were doing some renovations to convert a building, and they actually discovered that foundations of that original distillery building that burned down. They there was like the ancient ruins of the distillery.
Yeah.
So you have a little tour that can go through the meeting houses they built over that now. But now leading on to the point, or not the point, because that was not the point. Now, of course, bringing in the spooky point of this, all of this history and all of this time that this place has been in existence, there's got to be some ghosts, right?
Absolutely. You would think so. Something that old and all those buildings.
Also, anything industrial, like that's just anything that was through the Industrial Revolution has ghosts because.
Oh, yeah. Because there was no safety or anything. Yeah, it was just get them out of the way. Bring in the next one.
Sad but true. It's rumored to be one of the most haunted distilleries in America. The ghost that they talk about most is specifically Blanton's ghost. He died at the Stony Point Mansion, and people have seen him roaming the halls of the mansion. They hear him, you know, like talking,
petting a barrel,
perhaps petting a barrel. Just coming back from the afterlife to pet a barrel of whiskey. All right. The rumors, you know, they led eventually to a ghost hunting crew coming to film a TV show there. This happened in 2011. It was Ghost Hunters. I watched the episode before this. Their evidence was interesting, if not compelling.
I find all those shows to be kind of fake, but.
Well, you know, they specifically, let's see, the experience that they found the most, the biggest proof was that both of the lead investigators had their butts grabbed on the left cheek at the same time while on two different floors of the building.
And they have confirmation? They have a picture of somebody grabbing them?
No, they were alone, but they both reacted as if something had grabbed their butts at a similar timestamp. And so that's part of their great information, their great discovery.
And did they hear anything? It's just a butt grab.
Well, before the butt grab, they both heard a disembodied voice that on recording and reviewing it, they felt it said, "Oh, yeah."
Was it the Kool-Aid guy?
Maybe. Hey, somebody filled his pitcher with bourbon instead of Kool-Aid, and he just got loose.
Yeah, he got the bourbon in there instead of Kool-Aid. He was like, "Oh, yeah, it's butt-grabbing time." That seems like a weird thing for a ghost to do.
But they confirmed it. They confirmed it with two cheeks.
They confirmed it, huh? They had the old two-cheek confirmation test. Well, it must be right then.
I mean, you know, they saw shadows and orbs like they do. But the one story that I think gets repeated the most is that there was a crew working at one of the warehouses, and one of them heard a disembodied voice say, "Get out!" And so freaked out, he got him and his crew out of the building right when a wall collapsed. And so the story is that, oh, that's Blanton looking out for his workers to this day. Which, whether it's true or not, I like that story better than Blanton being somebody that's
grabbing butts.
Yeah, like, he seems like a pretty cool dude in his life. I don't really know if that's what I want to credit him with in his afterlife.
Yeah, really. Yeah, that Blanton, he knew his bourbon, but he was a real butt grabber.
He seems like a nice guy, you know? He built some gardens, like, just wanted to make things nice. I don't know.
Yeah, and that's what you get known for? What you're left in history? Man.
He apparently became a colonel at some point, too, because in the episode they kept referring to him as Colonel Blanton, which confused me, but I guess that's just, he got
he
it.
He sent in his money, and he became one. Kind of he sent him his plaque. Yeah. Yep, yeah, that's right.
So after the TV show aired, they then the distillery started doing ghost tours, which are very popular to this day. I don't know if they're doing, well, who knows? I don't know what Kentucky's like in COVID. Maybe they're doing, it's outdoors. They're probably still doing them. But
yeah, I looked, and they had the next two upcoming tours were sold out.
Oh, wow.
Now, they might be reduced from what they were, but besides the ghost tour, they also offer a tasting at the end. So.
Oh, nice. Wow.
Yeah.
Spirits and spirits. And,
Yeah. Now, and I also noticed there was one of them that was giving this information and setting up the tours, and the girl lives in Guyandotte.
Oh, really?
She's from here, yeah, which is right here by Huntington. And she was the one setting up the tours there. Well, we're only about 2 hours from Lexington, which is right where Frankfort is almost.
Okay.
Well, Louisville, I guess, is where is closer to Frankfort. Mom and I went up there. It's about 3 hours. Mom and I went up there a couple years ago, and we went on a tour of Buffalo Trace Distillery.
That's so cool. How was it? What was it like?
It was great. It's so steeped in history. Just like you say, it's not just that they can tell you this happened. They've got pictures of all these things, like barrel number 100 that was ever made there, you know, and stuff like that. And they've got these pictures of different milestone barrels that they hit. And they've got pictures of it in the different years of how it grew and everything, and all the different people. And it's, they're these giant wooden buildings everywhere. They look like they've all just been slapped up. There's nothing about it that's like modern construction or anything like that, you know?
That's really cool. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they redid it at the beginning, but then they just kept expanding.
Yeah. And the rickhouses are something else because they're just these giant wooden buildings. And the floors are real close together. Like the floors are like barely 6 feet apart because you want to fit all the barrels in there you can. So you walk in and the floor is only 6 feet high. It's like I had to duck down walking in an area. And then it's just these barrels that are back down through there. And they've got these different ways to move them while they're letting them sit there and age.
Oh, man. In the Ghost episode, they were talking about how there's a job that people do, which is, leak spotters, and you crawl beneath the space between and underneath the barrels to make sure nothing's leaking.
Right. Yeah, because, see, you have to pay taxes on those the whole time they're sitting in there, and tax is 60% of the cost of bourbon.
I can believe that.
Because you're paying for it sitting there while it's aging.
And that's why, you know, when I was looking at the whole portfolio of Buffalo Trace, there is a lot of stuff that it makes sense to me now, but like, you know, they do a lot of private labeling, which is basically they'll just give some young unaged spirit, they'll sell it off and let people age it on their own or, you know, do what they will with it. They do like some supermarket labels that they're not credited for. And, you know, it would be perhaps the thought to sort of look down on that, like, oh, you're diluting your product, you're selling it out. But that's really the stuff you have to do, because bourbon is whiskey in general. It's expensive because it has to sit there. And you really, right, to be a distiller that stays alive, I mean, they've stayed alive and they've kept in business and been massively successful for centuries. You have to be willing to kind of do the other things. You know, selling vodka or gin, that's another great way that, you know, mm-hmm, distilleries can stay afloat to make up for the bourbon that's just sitting there.
Well, blends are another way. They will get, like, they'll take part of a 4-year aged barrel and then they'll put it with one that's, say, aged 20 years,
sure,
and get a blend out of that. And then you've got a mid-range price. It's not the cheapest stuff, but it's not the most expensive stuff. And they'll sell it like that.
Yeah.
And then they innovate other products. One of the products that I came across when we were at Buffalo Trace that I bought a bottle of and brought home was something that called bourbon cream.
Oh.
And it's, you know how I like mudslides.
I know.
You know, Kahlua and Bailey's and things like that. Well, this is handcrafted using Buffalo Trace Kentucky Straight Bourbon, and they marry it with a rich, delicious cream and make it so that it's like a liqueur. And you can drink it just over ice if you want. You can put it in your coffee. Or they say what's really good is as a root beer, that you take 2 ounces of this bourbon cream, mix it with 4 ounces of root beer, and pour it over a scoop of vanilla ice cream.
That sounds amazing. Have you done that specifically?
I didn't make it with the float. I have had it. I did drink it straight, and I drank it mixed with just root beer. But I didn't have any vanilla ice cream at the time. And you do have to refrigerate that, though, once you open it, because of the cream in there. But they said, well, how long, somebody asked while we were on the tour, said, how long will it last once you open it? You know, how soon do you have to drink it? And he said, well, it'll last, if you put it in the refrigerator, it'll last a year. But if you don't drink it within a year, you don't deserve it.
Huh? Well, now wait, how long have you had that bottle?
Oh, it's gone.
Oh, okay.
It didn't last very long at all. It was good.
I was going to say, yeah, a lot of that depends on the alcohol content. But when you've got cream involved, there's always a shelf life.
Yeah. But it was delicious. I highly recommend that if you like those types of beverages.
I think that sounds good. I'm sure I couldn't drink it because I imagine is it not made from a vegan alternative?
Well, we could say that it is.
Yeah,
so you
not.
Could drink it.
It's not.
I don't know. I mean, it just says a cream, so I assume that's not a vegan alternative.
That's like Bailey's or whatever. That's fine. That sounds good though. I like that idea. And I mean, you can't fault them. I mean, they have so many amazing products under their label. Like, that's just...
Oh, yeah.
That's a Goliath of good bourbon.
Yeah, they gave us a sample of their... I guess it was vodka that they make there, too. And they gave us a sample of that when we were having the bourbon tastings, just so we could see what that was. One of the things that's creepy, too, if you're looking for, to make something spooky if you go on the ghost tour, is all the trees around the distillery, all the bark is black on all of them.
Why is that?
Because the alcohol that's coming out of the barrels that are all aging in the rick houses, the alcohol fumes turn the trees black.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so all the bark on all the trees around the area are black.
That's really creepy. I love that.
Yeah. The tree's not dead. It just has black bark.
Yeah. I wonder. Are all the trees drunk by proxy? It's absorbing?
They could be.
Maybe.
They're drunk to the trunk.
Yes.
They branched out and did some drinking.
Oh no.
We're gonna have to leaf this alone.
Oh no. Just keep it going. You did me dirty.
You didn't know what you were getting into when you said, let's do this.
I did. I absolutely did. Well, if you, obviously now is the time for social distancing. So I don't want to encourage anyone to do anything that interacts with other people. But I guess if it's an outdoor ghost tour, I would encourage you to check out the Buffalo Trace ghost tour. If not now, maybe someday in the future when we don't have a plague.
Yeah. Or they have the bourbon trail there. That's a big tourist thing, and it's a great thing. They'll take you around to like three different distilleries in the day, and you have tastings at all of them. And the only thing I would advise is whichever one you stop at first, make sure you buy a bottle of bourbon, because when you drink your bourbon in your tastings and then it takes you an hour or so to get to another one, you don't have any bourbon to drink in between. So make sure you bring a bottle you can drink on the bus.
That is a solid life hack. Bus yeah. Bourbon. That, just for the record, Dad just introduced you to bus bourbon. So
that's right.
Take
don't go
that.
Anywhere without it. You're not driving. You're just riding in the bus. So.
You got your overnight bag. You got your toothbrush. You got your bus bourbon.
Then you're ready to roll.
All right. It's like a traveler.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that a lot. There's this event called Camp Runamuck that happens, and I've always been too intimidated to apply, but it's basically a bunch of bartenders go to summer camp, and it's in Kentucky, and they learn about all the different distilleries around there and are at a summer camp, but it's adults. It's just kind of a fun, mess of a learning experience. But you kind of have to have connections in the industry to get in. You kind of have to be a cool bartender to get in. So I've never tried because,
I think you fit those qualifications.
I don't know. I think that's camp cool kid, like, but I would at some point like to visit the bourbon distilleries of Kentucky.
Yeah, that bourbon trail is well worth it. We stayed in Louisville and worked out of there. And it was great. And so we traveled around on that. And then the next day, we kind of just had a day to go out and go day drinking around Louisville. And they introduced me to a lawnmower beer.
What's a lawnmower beer?
Well, they had these different drink specials. And it was a shot and a lawnmower beer. And a lawnmower beer evidently is just a Miller or a Budweiser or something like that. They just refer to it as a lawnmower beer.
Oh, is it like?
I guess it's something... Like a guy out riding his riding mower out, driving around drinking a beer. That's what they're, I guess, referring to.
I like that. I think that's That's a great way of, that's a great way of referring to that. Well, you, so, it reminds me, when you, was it when you were up here, or was it when, I mean, maybe it was when Mom was up here. I know one of you were baffled by the notion of a beer and a shot. Like, I think that was you. We were talking about that. And you thought for sure the shot goes in the beer. Like, it's a, like the idea of that being sold as a combo.
Well, yeah, that does sound kind of fatal. You know, if you have too many of those, you're not going to last long if you're drinking shots in a beer, I don't think.
It's just a standard up here, though. Like, that's what you order.
That's the only time I've ever ordered it was shots and a shot in a lawnmower beer, and I said, I got to try that. And so that's what I got. But that's the only time I do. I'm not a hardcore drinker. I'm mostly a beer drinker, as you know.
Oh yeah. No,
now I would like to get a keg of Guinness, put in my house, and just have it on draft all the time.
I would like you to get a keg of Guinness in your house to have on draft all the time. I don't think we've talked about stouts on this show. I don't think we've talked about Guinness proper to an extent that we can't go back to it. Well, this has been great. I'm so psyched to have you here, Dad.
I am psyched to be here. I've had a blast talking with you. I don't get to talk with you enough, so this will be a great thing to do every week.
And I feel like, I was like, I've heard a lot of Dad's stories, but I haven't heard any of these, so that's great. It's just so much more territory to cover.
Well, when you were young, I didn't tell you many of the drinking stories. That's why you never knew about Bowie and me.
I can't believe I never heard. If I had known about Bowie and you, my life would have been different, is all I'm saying.
It's the dawning of the Diamond Dogs.
Oh, R.I.P. All right. Well, this has been fantastic. I'm so happy to have you on board. I am from here. We are going to have so much more fun, and we're going to cover so much cool alcohol history and weird and very cool dad stories. So please hang in there with us. just the beginning.
Tolerate the dad jokes.
Yes. It is time for a second round of neat. We are psyched to have you on board. all right. The housekeeping is, if you want to follow us, you can find us on Neat Boozecast on both Instagram and Twitter. If you would like to support us on Patreon, that would be great too. We are Neat the Boozecast on Patreon. You get some stickers at a $4 level. You get some coasters hand-drawn by me at an $8 level. And for a dollar, you just get my love and occasional live streams. Now with me and my dad. I'm that on a live stream. Oh, boy. Tommy Smurl unfiltered. You want that? It costs a dollar.
Can you edit that? I hope you can edit that.
No, I can't. Nobody can.
No, we'll have to be on a 10-second delay or have your mother standing there with a mallet standing near me to hit me on the head or something.
I think that's what we'll do. I think that will be your end of the live stream. It'll be you and Mom armed. and of course, if you have any questions, comments, episode ideas, feel free to email us at meettheboozecast@gmail.com. Well, I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
Neat. It's just like we said in the promo. I've got almost 50 years of drinking experience.
Exactly. You have David Bowie experience. I don't know.
That's right.
but no, I think this is really good.